What impact has the Ukraine war with Russia had on the world, and what does the future hold? This is the Propaganda Report's Drive Time, News Blast, and Nighttime News Blast. Today, joining me is Cam Harless, host of the Mad Ones podcast. Cam, good to see you. Cam was showing me his new weapons prior to the show, so that's always fun.
This is actually the gun that Alec Baldwin used to shoot his coworker.
And you got it at a pawn shop. He must have left it there, Hunter Biden style.
Right, I had to wipe off his fingerprints, but that's fine. That's very low maintenance. So
right, it'll help him get off, and we can enjoy his movies, and we can enjoy the movie Rust, which I'm sure he'll go back to work on in the future.
I'm sure.
So, what I want to talk about today is I want to play some clips for you all from a Chatham House panel discussion that I watched yesterday. I watched it live, actually. Me and 11 other people watched it live. But they said some pretty interesting things, to say the least. But it's some pretty heavy stuff, or it's a heavy subject anyway. So before that, I want to start with something a little more lighthearted and quick that I thought was really funny. It's about Tiger Woods. And I saw
the
story.
Beat him up again with a 9-iron?
No, that was years ago, and he's reformed himself a little bit. And he's found favor in some portions of the country because of his resurgence. And this story from the AP, Tiger Woods had some explaining to do Friday about a chauvinist prank he played on Justin Thomas in the Genesis Invitational. The fact that they call this chauvinist and they don't think that this type of stuff happens in sports all the time.
What kind of chauvinism?
I know. I'm going to tell you what kind of chauvinism it is. It says, in his return to elite competition for the first time in 7 months, Woods caused quite a buzz in the opening round for all the wrong reasons. It started when he ripped a 323-yard drive some 10 yards longer than the 29-year-old Thomas. Walking off the tee, Woods discreetly put something in Thomas's hand, which Thomas then tossed to the ground when he realized what it was, which was a tampon. The article goes on to explain the joke to us, to remind him that Woods hit the ball further than he did. Woods laughed and put his arm around Thomas, and later Woods said it was supposed to be all fun and games, and obviously it hasn't turned out that way because people were getting pissed at him. Woods said, he said, if it offended anybody in any way, shape, or form, I'm sorry. It wasn't intended to be that way. It was just, we play some pranks on one another all the time. And virally, I think this did not come across that way. And he's right. Anybody who's played sports, who's been in a locker room talk is real. People play pranks on each other in sports all the time. I have a quick video of the incident in question. And you can see here. I'm assuming this person says busted coverage. Yes, Tiger Woods 100% handed Justin Thomas a tampon after he outdrove him. And we can watch that clip there. Good.
How far did Justin Thomas hit it?
323, or he must have hit 313, though.
I think the offense here is Tiger making the bold assertion that a woman could hit a golf ball that far.
That's so chauvinist of you, Cam. So chauvinist of you. Here it is.
Sinker stayed on the ground. Gets in. This one's headed a little left. Got a nice bounce.
Like your mother.
Is not very long at all, so no issues. Pretty good ball right there. Good friends indeed. Sinker stayed on the ground.
Okay. Offensive. Yeah.
No, very, very, very offensive. I was just checking to make sure we were live on Rockfin. I think there might be a bit of delay.
Yeah.
We are.
I'll let you know if we're not. If you're not.
Thank you. Yeah. Usually, I think mine's delayed a bit for some reason. But yeah. So That is very mild compared to what some people do. If you want to hear about some dirty jokes that athletes played, which this happens, you play sports all of the time, look up Greg Maddux dirty. And Greg Maddux, who was in the Hall of Fame, one of the best pitchers of all time, Braves pitcher, multiple Cy Youngs, is one of the dirtiest people that ever played the game. And you can hear his teammates talking about just the nasty pranks he used to play on them. If you think this is chauvinist, look up about Greg Maddux's pranks.
Well, do you remember Jared Leto in Suicide Squad, all of the things that did to his coworkers?
Yeah, he sent condoms to the, like, used condoms to his fellow.
Actually used, but they were like, he made them look like they were. And like
he made him look like
a dead rat. But yeah, so Lacey had the same question I do. Why did he just have one on hand? He was planning it. He was really hoping he hit that ball further.
Absolutely planning it. He probably had a handful of them on hand in case he wanted to do it again. There's probably all kind of stuff in his pocket. This is what athletes do. They look forward to outmanning the other athlete, so to speak, and then doing something like that to him. It's just how sports work. And I guarantee you, in women's sports, it's the same way. It's how athletes are in general.
I do want to say that Cornelius said, "Are you taking a swing at lady golfers, Viking?" That's me. yeah, because if I took a swing at them, I'd hit them farther than they could hit themselves.
Yeah, taking a swing at lady golfers, I believe, was the joke implied there. Yes, of course.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Okay, so now that we got that out of the way, and I have a couple of fun things that we'll do after this as well, because we can make this fun, but it is a heavy subject. So this panel discussion at the Chatham House. And the Chatham House is the 100-year-old think tank, the International House of Royal, the Institute of Royal Affairs. I think it's either the mother or the sister. I think it's the mother of the CFR, and it's one of the top like two or three influential think tanks in the planet where they get together and they try and create world policy. I always talk about the guy, Sir Andrew Wood.
Who let these people decide that they could have a stupid club that's considered a nonprofit where they get paid handsomely to just chat about how to destroy the world?
Exactly. I should bring the clip back sometime of Sir Andrew Wood, where he, and this is the guy who was the mentor of the Christopher Steele guy, who is the guy who did the Russia dossier back in 2016. Yeah. This is his mentor. And this is actually the guy who alerted John McCain to the existence of that dossier. They introduce him at this one panel discussion in 2015. They say, and of course, Andrew Wood. And as people are clapping, he goes, "I like to break up countries." And they all have a good laugh over how he likes to break up countries. This is that place. And a lot of these people, their assignments seem to be to break up countries. Now, this panel discussion, and Cam, I can't see a lot of the comments because I'm on one screen today, and so I'm having to switch back and forth.
I'll watch for you.
I appreciate it. So this is the title of this panel discussion.
Do you know who Cecil Rhodes is?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, because Frightened Me said that he created the Royal Institutes through his secret wills.
Oh, did he really? Now, that's interesting. I did not know that. That's very interesting.
That's what I'm learning. That's what I'm learning from Frightening Me right now.
Fantastic.
And it is frightening me.
This panel discussion is titled Ukraine. Wait, where's the title of it? It's about, here it is. How it changed the Russia invasion of Ukraine, how it changed the world. And that's what they're talking about. And they talk about, you know, what's going on now and what they believe might happen in the future. And the first clip is a lady named Orissa Lucevic, which I've played some clips of her before. She's a research fellow and of the Russia and Eurasia program and head of the Ukraine Forum. And let me get this up on
screen. I can't wait to see her. If I recognize her, I think I know who you're talking about.
I think, well, I'll tell you, she is, she has quite an interesting look going on right here. She's wearing a white sport coat with a black lapel trim going all the way down. She looks like she's dealing poker in the back room of a Ukraine speakeasy with this outfit that she's wearing here. Let me get that up on the screen. There she is. Look at that outfit there. She got the haircut of every girlfriend of every villain in every 80s action movie, except it's usually blonde. There we go. All right. So here in this first clip, do you remember her? Because I did play.
I don't know if I remember her, but I already don't like looking at her.
She is speaking on what she calls the vicious irony of Putin's assault on Ukraine. And here's what she has to say about that. Vicious.
I thought you said delicious for a second there.
And I was like, I think they think it's pretty delicious when you hear what she has to say.
There's this vicious irony where Russia is erasing its own imprint in southeast of Ukraine, where indeed, when Putin spoke today again about gathering of these, what he calls historic lands.
She said erasing their imprint, erasing Russia's imprint.
He is erasing everything that has been, to a degree, achieved through colonization of Russian Empire to southeast of Ukraine. He is destroying cities, Ukrainian cities like Mariupol, Volnovakha, Bakhmut, Energodar. He's bombing Dnipro, Kharkiv, where there's mainly Russian-speaking population that lives there, that he himself, in his twisted mind, says he is trying to protect. And all of this results in a silver lining, kind of the bright side of this, where it is actually destroying, putting the nail in the coffin of the Russian world. And what it means, it's this kind of neo-Soviet nostalgia, historical manipulation of what has happened and why Ukrainian nation doesn't exist. It's this imperial grandeur that Putin very much wants to make his own legacy that is completely collapsing in Ukraine as we speak, as walls and, you know, windows of Ukrainian houses are collapsing.
So the silver lining there, putting the nail in the coffin of the Russian world. I'll tell you what my takeaway is there, then we'll see what your thoughts are, Cam. It sounds like what she's saying is that by destroying Ukraine and seemingly winning this war, Putin is doing Russia and himself in, and that is, in fact, the silver lining, is that destruction of Putin's Russia. Why would that be the silver lining? Well, there's a couple of reasons, mainly because with Ukraine destroyed, these people can now do what they've wanted to do for some time now, which is build Ukraine back better. I mean, they should thank Russia for what's going on here, because they don't have to do it since they've gotten him to do it. They should thank the families of the dead Ukrainians who've been sacrificed for this. So that would seem, to me anyway, that this silver lining she talks about was the purpose all along when it comes to the Great Reset. And I think that that's what this is about right here. What are your thoughts?
There's a lot to think about with this whole Russia deal. Like, there really are people in different areas of Ukraine that want to be a part of Russia, and there was war. Ukraine was at war.
The Azov battalion after those people, dude.
Right. Well, it's like, so there's like some legitimate things to think about. What's going on there? Why would Putin do this? And it's the fact, I think that they've just manipulated him into doing what he did.
Yeah, I would agree. And we're going to hear a clip on how they characterize what Putin's perspective is on this here in a second, which is pretty funny. But next, we have this person named Dr. Patricia Lewis, who listened to this title. Actually, this might be the clip I was referring to.
Real quick, who was it that bombed Mariupol?
I mean, they say that Russia did, okay. But you know, there's a lot of, was a lot asking, of questions.
She thought it was. She was saying, wasn't it Zelensky that bombed Mariupol? Well, but
see, there's questions about that, and there's questions about a lot of the places where Bucha, they say that Russia came in and just, you know, destroyed all these people, when there's counter evidence to suggest it was the Azov battalion that are the ones that the Nazis in the Ukraine army that went in there and did that. So, and this is all going to be written by the winners of the war, is essentially what that is going to boil down.
Well, and that's one of those things, is the propaganda is so good, they chose the winner. It's like, remember when George W. Bush got in front of the one of those helicarriers or whatever they're called.
Terrorist
mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished.
But like years before Iraq was done, right?
Right, and that's what they've been doing here with Ukraine.
That's what I'm saying. Exactly. They chose the winner. They're saying mission accomplished, and it seems like every time I hear news from about how they're breaking Russia. Oh man, I just remembered that, talking about that freaking grenade video. That's what I got mad about last time we had a show.
Yeah.
And so yet I see these things, and it's always too well planned out for it to be.
It does feel that way. And like right here, this woman was just describing Russia as just destroying Ukraine, yet at the same time, the walls are crumbling, everything's just gone, yet somehow Ukraine is still winning. So that seems to be a bit contradictory.
But that's the thing. It doesn't line up with what they're saying. There is just no way, unless they have, which they say they don't, right? They just have trainers from other countries. Like, if they don't have people on the ground fighting this war for them, there's no winning it against Russia.
Exactly. Yeah. And they get a question about that towards the end here, which is interesting. It's interesting to see how they answer it, because in my opinion, it's a lie. And the next woman speaking here, listen to this title. Dr. Patricia Lewis, this is a moderator, the acting deputy director of conflict and science and transformation at Chatham House. She's the director of conflict and the science of transformation. So your job is to create conflict and transformation. These titles. So how does a person like this not do that? Yeah, right. The scientific art of transformation with conflict, I guess she focuses on. And she explains very quickly, this is what I was talking about a moment ago, how they view Putin, and his claims that NATO infringement is what caused the war.
I mean, Putin does remind us of a gaslighting spouse who says, you know, you made me do it, after he hits his wife.
A gaslighting spouse who says, you made me do it.
I'll be honest with you, the accent, I heard spaz.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's kind of hilarious.
Yeah.
But no, the fact that they have completely at this point dismissed that there are Russian speaking ethnic Russians within the borders of Ukraine that do not want to be a part of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. They've erased these people from existence in everyone's minds.
They talk about that. I didn't pull clips from it, but they do talk about how they.
But that's what she's saying. Oh, you made me do this.
Right.
No, they want to eliminate literally, the Russian
they
language.
Literally did. I know. And they it's projection of the highest order. And I'm not here to say that like Russia or Putin is completely innocent or not a wrongdoer in any ways. I'm saying this stuff is all a gray area of conflict that they don't like to talk about, because they want to divide people along clean, simple lines that they can propagandize them into shaping the world the way that they want to shape it.
Well, and that's the thing. It's none of our business, but they've made it our business. Yes, they've shoved it down our throats.
Especially with that. All of this. But, you know, Biden going over there to Ukraine, and which was, I talked about on the show on Monday. Clearly
the video this with the sirens.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. And the media talking about how that was just some brave thing he did, when they actually told Russia they were going to be there before they left so they could make sure nothing bad happens. There's nothing brave about it. It was all protected and safe. And it looked like they were at Disney World in some of these photos. It was just a joke.
But what's incredible about it is these air raid sirens, regardless of what they're doing, the people, if they heard them, unless they were prepped in advance, we're doing this as a show. We're doing this as a play.
Absolutely.
They would run into their houses.
Right, they would just stay out
there. Where was
the
panic?
Yeah, totally. Well, there was a CNN reporter who maybe afterwards got a little bit reprimanded, who reported somebody on the ground here says they hadn't heard air raid sirens in like a really long time. I don't know if it was hours or days. I think it was days. And then when Biden got here and was walking through the square, all of a sudden air raid sirens. It's almost like they're mocking us with how obvious this is. Okay. All right.
I hope someone beats up Zelensky.
Zelensky is such a joke, and I just don't know how anybody can
really
take
is.
Him seriously.
But like honestly, if this thing was a movie, a comedy, like I know that he met him and he talked well about him, but like who could play him better than what's his name? Ben Stiller.
Yes.
Could you imagine Ben Stiller being like, come here, president. Check this out. We're going to do the sirens. Everyone knows that this doesn't mean shit.
You're right, dude. I love that we were both on Ben Stiller there. That's great. Now, Sean Penn would want to play him, but Sean Penn couldn't do the comedic part as well.
That's true.
As Ben Stiller could. Sean Penn recently said that Zelensky was made for this moment. Yeah, he was. They made him for this moment. You're exactly right.
Just like, what's her name? AOC was made for Congress in her moment.
Yes, she was. With her
just like Obama was crafted in a lab for his moment.
Yes, made in some clone lab. Okay, next we have, who is this chick? All right, these people are all doctors here. Now, this is Dr. Leslie Vinjamuri. She's the director and the U.S. She's the director in the U.S. and the America programs, of the U.S. and America programs at Chatham. And she is giving through this discussion the American perspective, you know, from her, at least what she says the American perspective is. And she's talking here about the tensions between what she calls the West and the rest. And where things could be headed from here, and
that is chauvinistic.
That's
the
very
West
chauvinistic
and the rest is Western chauvinistic.
Absolutely.
We all know that the rest, in terms of GDP and population, are not with the West on this war. But one of the real challenges is that, you know, the major players in the rest, China and India being two, have said for a very long time that what they cared about was sovereignty. And that does not seem to be where they're putting their cards in this particular war, which leads me to believe that the tension and the conflict between the West and the rest is much graver than we think, because if they're not willing to back the UN Security Council resolution sanctioning Russia for its invasion of Ukraine, a clear violation of the UN Charter, and clearly speaking to what they've said matters most, then clearly there's a whole lot more going on that isn't just about sovereignty. There's fundamental contestation, not only over values, but over who's going to control the globe.
Wow, over who's going to control the globe, and that sounds to me like a threat, honestly. You're either going to, the rest, I mean, that's very belittling and demeaning, something Hitler might say, even. You're either going to agree to this treaty, or it's going to be much graver than you anticipate. That's kind of what I took away from that.
What's her name again?
Her name is Dr. Leslie Vinjamuri. Vinjamuri.
One thing I was going to say is, did you notice within the way she was talking about it, again, they are asserting the definition of specific words. So they're saying, you know, China, they care about sovereignty, but they're not caring about it in this moment because ... But I guarantee you the people in Donbass do care a lot about sovereignty.
Right. What's her definition of sovereignty anyway? It's probably
and there
not
is,
actual sovereignty.
They're asserting that the sovereignty means that Ukraine gets to rule over anyone in that area that around these arbitrary lines, despite them wanting to self-govern or join another state.
Absolutely. It's their way, or it's a very grave time in the future.
Right.
And here she continues. Where is that there? Talking about what could happen next after the war, if the war does end. And here's what she has to say.
So going forward, I guess just a few quick thoughts. We know that there's a fundamental question of whether unity will be maintained inside the US, whether unity will be maintained inside of Europe and across Europe, and whether the unity will be maintained between the US and Europe. We have a big question mark about how much stronger the alliance will become between China and Russia. If that becomes stronger and the West becomes weaker, we're in some pretty grave trouble. And then a final comment, I guess, on the US, and the big outstanding question is what happens in the US after 2024? I'm on the optimistic side, which I think is grounded in evidence. But I recognize that there's a whole lot that could happen. A week is a long time in politics. But obviously, if there's a fundamental change of leadership and any other number of things that could happen in the U.S., then the whole bet on the question of Western unity will also change.
Unity meaning what?
I see. That's what I'm curious about. One, they have 2024 circled. Donald Trump running again and all of that. And the comment about is the unity in the U.S. and with the, I think, would she say Europe is going to stay together? So is that to me is, I'm wondering if that's, this is something that I've thought for a while, is the way that Biden, ever since he released that countering domestic terrorism strategy back in 2021, which targets anybody, saying domestic terrorism is the biggest threat and targets people who literally can corn. That's what they mentioned in the Council on Foreign Relations when talking about this, because those people are a threat to democracy. They talk about those people who question the election, people who question the vaccine, who question the mandates, the same way that they talk about Putin and Russia, that they're anti-democratic, they're threatening our democracy. And I wonder if that comment about will the U.S. stay together is a comment on what are we going to have to do about these people who continue to want to live, be able to live off the land, who continue to not bow down to the mandates of the government. Are we going to have to treat them the same way as Russia? I don't think it's going to get that extreme, but I am wondering if that's what she's referring to in a comment like that.
Well, she also said that she is optimistic. And she believes what? Did she say the science, or was she like the statistics back her up?
She said evidence backed, I think.
Evidence, right? Okay, yeah. But
like present the evidence then.
Right. What do you mean optimistic? Do you mean that Trump won't win? That DeSantis won't win? What do you mean by optimistic?
Yeah. I think that she means. See, that's a good question. I think she means that whoever wins is going to side with these globalists. I don't know. Okay. I don't know who she's referring to. Like maybe she's referring to DeSantis or another Republican or something. I don't know. But DeSantis seems to, just in his statements, oppose this type of stuff.
Yeah, but it's just, I'm just realizing like there are, and I'm not realizing, I know it, but I'm realizing out loud because I think it's somewhat helpful, is all of the words that they're using, they just assume you understand exactly what they mean by that.
Right. And I should tell you.
They've asserted a definition.
Yeah, they're talking to each other with those definition assertions. Yeah. Because, like I said, there was 12 people watching the live stream of this, which I watched.
Did you say 12?
Yes, 12 people.
You said millions.
No, 12. There was 12 people watching it. Me, and I was one of them. So me and 11 other people.
Well, right now there are 11 people watching on Rockfin.
We have just as many.
And six people. We have more.
Yeah, right. We're not trying to dominate the globe. Yeah, and the video only had 123 views when I went to go cut these clips. So these things don't get watched much. So they're directing the stuff towards the people who are there and the very few people who are watching online. And yeah, so they assume that they all know what those definitions mean. And all right, next we have, this is Dr. Patricia Lewis again, our director of conflict. And she asked a question that reflects what I was commenting on a moment ago, that shows what I think, how they view what's going on in Ukraine, what I think ultimately the end game is.
Perhaps, Arisha, we could start with you, what your vision for reconstruction would look like. Is it build back better?
Reconstruction.
What will reconstruction of Ukraine be? Is it build back better, which is the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab program.
But I just need you to know that, like, think about the PTSD that Southern Americans have when they hear the word Reconstruction.
And you know what? Oh, God, that's a great point, dude. Yeah, she should choose. See, it's funny because she did go on to say that's such a bad term, admitting, because people have like responded like badly to that term in the U.S. anyway. And she should have thought about how they might respond to that Reconstruction term.
Right, but that's what they want, because that's what Reconstruction was after the war between the states, the Civil War, whatever you want to call it, the War of Northern Aggression, if you will. It was an assertion of sovereignty, of taking over an area that didn't want to be controlled by this federal government. Right. And it was a sea change, and they history, there's all sorts of stuff. I'm not making a stance about who was right, who was wrong, but if you look at the Southern United States and you see how they even talk about themselves, you can see how we've been propagandized to hate ourselves.
Absolutely.
And that is what they will do in Donbass.
Absolutely. And that's a fantastic point. I hadn't thought about that with the Reconstruction terminology. God. So here is Orisa, the backroom poker dealer from Ukraine, responding. This is part of her response to that Reconstruction of Ukraine question.
The thinking about the type of Ukraine that must emerge out of this war.
I have to stop it there. Look at that belt, which is also just way too live. I don't know what that belt looks like, a giant pair of brass knuckles to me.
Well, it honestly, like, I don't know what it is, but it either looks like General Grievous from Star Wars or Cthulhu.
Yeah, it looks Cthulhu.
From H.P. Lovecraft's, like, one of the Elder Gods, like, kind of a squid face dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this looks Elder Godish. That's all I'm saying.
Interesting outfit. But
what was it that she just said? Because she threw me again.
Yeah, I'll take it back. She's talking about the Reconstruction. Oh.
Yeah, go again. Yeah.
All right.
The thinking about the type of Ukraine that must emerge out of this war is here, and it takes place across government, across business community, across civil society. And what is very clear is that it will be Ukraine that complies and resembles the type of a European Union nation that includes green transition, that includes decentralized governments, that includes power to the regions, that also includes quite strong logistics links with the European Union, that includes integration of Ukraine within the European energy system, trade, something that is clear now. What makes Ukraine resilient today is something that Ukraine wants to build on, but again, more and better, is digital.
More and better. They want to build on more and better instead of building back better.
The economy is...
I talked over that because that's actually...
No, you're good. I just thought
that was funny how she changed that up a little bit.
I'm just listening to how this woman is essentially describing brainwashing as a term.
Yes.
But like washing away the Slavic mind.
Yep.
And in putting Western colonial, really... values.
Yeah, they'll bow down to the New World Order is what it sounds like to me. And she's almost done with that.
Dawn, but again, more and better, is digital economy, is IT sector. It's in addition to its agriculture that is a powerhouse and that actually could drive a lot of growth and innovation around that. Ukraine wants to keep that more modern type economy. And to be honest, Ukrainians have a very modernization agenda. We run the survey of civil society organization late November, beginning of December, and most groups say we need to modernize Ukraine, not just rebuild it the way it is.
Okay, and that goes back to what
this woman
saying
is saying that Ukraine needs to be modernized, while she is wearing the same jacket that Indiana Jones wore in 1935 in the Obi-Wan Club in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Not Raiders of the Lost Ark, Temple of Doom.
Yeah,
I'm just saying.
She also supports an army that the backbone of that army is Nazis. So also
the same people that Indiana Jones fought. It's like they want more memorabilia. And she got the jacket. I'm jealous of the jacket, but I would never wear it in public.
Not in a serious function, anyway. I don't think I'd wear that in public. So a couple of things from her comments there. The focus on the digital economy there is an important thing. So Ukraine, I think it was in 2019, I think, or 2020, they committed itself to becoming the world's first government entirely digital. It's an e-government, as they call it, meaning everyone's important information is linked to some digital system accessible by the government. And, you know, for the purpose of making things easier for everybody, you know, that ease of access. And we've actually helped this along. Listen to this. This is from the USAID press release. And they talked about this at Davos also. A US-supported e-government app accelerated the digital transformation of Ukraine. Now Ukraine is working to scale the solution to more countries. And then the article or the press release goes on to say that an award-winning Ukraine e-government app and digital platform supported by the United States is accelerating Ukraine's digital transformation. This is what they're building Ukraine back better to be. Ukraine is a testing ground for many, many things, and they admit this, but it's also a testing ground for the world's first fully digitized e-government, and this is the infrastructure they're going to be building back better to support, which we are also helping them in this as well as the war. That's one of the main focuses of this new Build Back Better in Ukraine that they're going for. All right. Next we have, who's talking next? Next we have this person whose name is, I guess, Creon, not Crayon, but C-R-E-O-N, Butler, who is the research director of trade and investment and of new governance models. This guy's the research director of new governance models here and the director of the global economy and finance programs at Chatham House. He answers a question very quickly that I've been curious as to what the answer to this question is for quite some time now, which is how much money we've actually given to Ukraine. It's surprisingly difficult to find this exact number published anywhere, but he says what I guess he thinks it is.
Western spending is already $140 billion since the war began. That's both military and economic and other support. 50% of that is from the U.S.
$140 billion with 50% coming from the U.S. And I got to say, I thought we had spent a lot more. You know, we've only given them $70 billion, according to this guy. So I think we need to stop shortchanging them. Yeah, I think it's probably bull as well.
I also don't believe that the freaking rest of the world matched America.
Right.
I don't believe that.
It used to be, the talking point used to be that we've given like 85 or 90% of it. And now they're saying that it's been half and half.
50-50? Bull crap.
Yeah. Which is like funny to me. When Biden did his little staged play on a movie set in Ukraine the other day, which looked like Disney World, some of the photos, at the end of it, or he probably announced it before, but he gave Ukraine, he told Zelensky, you know what, we're going to give you another $500 million, which I have to say, Ukraine must have been pretty insulted by anything less than $1 billion at this point, like spitting in their face.
It's like going on a first date and going to Ruth's Chris and then being
you don't start there.
You know what, baby? We're gonna go to Golden Corral for the second date.
You gotta start at Golden Corral. And you can then slowly work your way up.
Because Golden Corral is middle class fancy. You gotta start there. And you could only go up for there.
Right. Golden Corral, which probably took a major hit during the pandemic because of the bar, it's like all you can eat at Golden Corral, right?
Yeah.
I used to love Golden Corral.
The one that was near us, actually, it was here and open because we moved here March 2020. And now it was bulldozed and it's now an Aldi. So yeah, I don't think they did well.
Yeah, it's where you used to also be able to find every old person after church on Sunday there and the Piccadilly.
Yeah, well, okay, so I'm so happy you said Piccadilly because I make Piccadilly jokes because I'm from the South. I didn't realize that was mostly a Southern thing. And so like when I've made jokes about, like I have a friend who goes to bed at like 9 p.m. and I was like, did you get the buffet at Piccadilly? Yeah. And he's like, I don't know what that is. And I'm like, Morrison's? He's like, no. And I'm like, where do you go? Where do old people go? Denny's? Do I have to say Denny's to make this joke?
Only Southern as well. I had no idea.
Yeah, Piccadilly jokes don't work. So
that is good to know.
Gotta stay in the South.
Piccadilly, you can look it up if you guys aren't from the South. All right, so back to this chick here who's talking from the U.S. perspective, and she talks, and I think a lot of people are going to relate to this. She talks about how Americans feel about long wars, you know? And I think she actually reveals how to defeat these people in the process.
That over time, he was looking at Americans. I suspect it's true far beyond the United States, that as the longer that wars go on, the more that they lose domestic support. And that's shown in Vietnam, that's shown in Afghanistan. These are not all the same conflicts by any stretch of the imagination. But on this dimension of public support, you lose public support the longer you're in a war. So part of what President Biden is trying to do, for multiple reasons, only one of them is about the domestic audience, is to shore up that support. And I think what we saw at Munich, what we heard at Munich, what we all know is that absent momentum, it's going to be hard to get the kind of successes on the ground that will sustain popular support and infuse that through Congress. But to your specific question about what happens as the U.S. moves into, we're still a little ways off, but a year from now, we're not going to be very far off. We're going to be in an election season, which is very hard to imagine. But boy, is it going to look radically different in the U.S., the nature of political debate. And I hate to say it, but it does seem very likely that partisanship around U.S. spending and its impacts and its successes and what is Europe doing. And has Europe stayed the course? Has Europe stayed united? Has Europe paid its share?
No.
I think that debate is going to be fundamentally different if we meet again in 1 year's time.
If the war's still going on, is what she's saying.
Are they meet again? So are they? Is she saying that they actually are paying more? Is that what's changing in the debate, or what?
Well, I think what's changing is that's going to be the debate. Is Trump?
That's
is the one
that was the debate. That was the debate in 2016.
Right, but then
so it's not changing.
The debate. Yeah, but see, they don't want that to be the debate. They want the debate to be just give Ukraine money because they need to defeat this because they're fighting on the front lines of democracy worldwide. And she's absolutely right about Americans not, and probably not just Americans. Lots of people around the world don't like. Most people don't like war in general. Okay. They are the ones that like war and these elongated wars, people definitely don't like, and their messaging loses its ability. The propaganda is, the effectiveness goes down the longer the war goes on. And so that tells me that one of the main ways you beat these people is with anti-war messaging, which is something that you would think Democrats would be completely on board with if they're not completely just mind-controlled with it. And I think a lot of them actually are. I think their messaging is already weakening because of the length of this war. And so I think you can call somebody a Nazi who's preaching anti-war, I just don't know how you can believe that. And that seems to be their tactic. And she needs to button her blouse up, by the way.
They call everyone who is anti-war a Nazi.
Right.
Like that is very common at this point. Alex Jones, not for the wars, Nazi. Right. Scott Horton, not for the wars, obviously a Nazi. Like what everyone, but
I'm not for the war. If they call me a Nazi, then send me that multi-billion-dollar weapons package, because that's what we do to Nazis, is we give them money if they're in Ukraine. I'm not going to Ukraine by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, and that's what's funny is they're kind of right. Longer wars lose, popular support. But Vietnam didn't lose support because it was long.
It lost support.
Afghanistan lost support because it was long, but that was 20 years, right? Vietnam wasn't 20 years. It was not the same as Afghanistan. People love a wartime president, though.
Because they do in the beginning, anyway. If a crisis happens.
Remember the Gulf, the first Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm.
Is that the one where the babies in incubators propaganda was?
Right. And so the Kuwait deal. And George H.W. Bush gave you a short war. But what he realized is that people don't love long wars, but they love wartime presidents. And you don't get elected unless there's a war going on. You don't get reelected.
Yes, totally. So let me see what clip we got here and see what will, because I'm going to save a few of these for the XR. And okay, I'm going to save the rest of these clips for the XR. What I'm going to do to close out the subject is I'm going to skip to, I'm going to show you, and for those listening, you'll have to go to the video somewhere. The video is on YouTube, so if you want to check it out, I'm going to show you what a face tattoo of a vagina looks like. Have you ever seen one of these, Cam?
I have not. I'm thinking of getting one, but...
Well, now you're going to know how it's actually going to look here. The headline, this is a new from the New York Post. It is.
I don't know if you could tell, though. I do like tattoos.
Yes, I know you do. That's why I was showing you this, because I was wondering if maybe you were considering it. Headline is, I got a vagina tattoo inked on my face. The artist tried to talk me out of it. And before I show you that, if you guys do want to get access to the XR, where we will finish up with these clips, which they say some extraordinary things that talk about secret backroom deals and how they even don't trust each other, then you can go to patreon.com/propagandareport, subscribe there today. And let's get this up there on screen. Here we go. All right, so you see the headline there, Cam, and scroll down a little bit. Oh, well, it's blocked out. But we're going to go to the part that's not blocked. A veteran tattoo artist, Michael Ralph, inked an image of a vagina across a young client's cheek. The customer has been slammed on social media. Slammed. It's interesting language there.
Permanent vagina facial?
Yep, permanent vagina facial. It's can be interpreted in many ways, I think. And where's the image? Oh, there it is. There it is. Can you see that? Let me see if I can.
Yeah, I can. Far. Why would you do that? This is going to get taken off of YouTube, bro.
Look at that. This person has that on there. I hope that person doesn't go to prison.
Maybe. I mean,
can you imagine what will happen to this person in prison? That is awful. I mean, part of me feels bad for him, but the fact that he was urged not to get it, I'm like, dude, bro, what are you doing?
I mean, well, it's realistic. It's almost hyper realistic, but it also, like, the background to the left and to the right do not make it look okay. So that
it's
brings
like an optical illusion.
3D. Yeah. Yes, but it makes it look like it's been sliced off rather than it's like connected. If that makes sense, it just looks like it's hanging there from his thing.
It's
his
mutton chops. He also grew it where it's also where his sideburns are, so he can like grow hair on it and stuff like that. So that's something he can look forward to.
Oh, geez, you're not wrong.
Yeah, dude, it's like this tattoo artist was like, I don't think you should get this tattoo. But then when the guy said he's going to get it, that tattoo artist went on to do the best, most detailed tattoo he'd ever done in his life with this piece of work here. This guy should be in a museum and have climate activists throwing, you know, peanut butter or smearing peanut butter on him or something with this piece of art. It was extraordinary. If you're applying for a job as this guy, you have to look one way the entire time. I think you're not getting the job.
I'm a very responsible person who never does anything stupid.
Yeah.
Could you look at me full on?
Right. Although if he did, if he applied to the White House, he'd probably get hired along with the guy in the dog suit.
Only if he put on a dress first.
Right. And if he goes and steals luggage or something like that, then they'll definitely welcome him in. All right. So we're going to continue this.
But seriously, it looks like it's hanging from his face. That's the real sticking point. It's like the top even looks blended as if it's supposed to be hanging. Yeah. Like if he did this, I feel like it would go.
Yeah, it's a real sticking point. Yes, of course. It's an amazing work of art. Impressive. I feel bad for the guy, but man, I'm sure they'll be able to laser it off one way or another, hopefully. And with that childish story, we'll take this into the DMB XR and continue with these clips. Thank you, Cam, for joining me and helping out. Thank you guys in the chats. And we will continue for those on Rockfin. And we'll talk to you guys next time. Have a fantastic rest of your day. At freedomactradio.com or at freedomactradio on Twitter. Cam, you want to promote anything before we hit the music?
Go. At him, Carlos, on Twitter. That's all I'm good for.
All right.